Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before we get today's wonderful guest, I just want to draw attention once again to my website, www. MarkPattisonNFL.com. And again, there's a big link with a red button that you can go and you can see the wonderful film the NFL did, the NFL 360, called Searching for the Summit. It's a beautiful film about my Everest journey, about my daughter, Amelia, overcoming epilepsy. And it's very inspiring. They did a great job. Number two, the philanthropy tab. I continue to work with Higher Ground. And we have created a program called Amelia's Everest. Amelia's Everest is raising funds to once again help others, including herself, overcome head trauma and other adaptive issues through empowerment. I just love that. They're based here in Sun Valley. So if you want to go and make a donation, please do. 100% of all proceeds go to Higher Ground. And finally, there's so many podcasts I've done, 225 of amazing people doing incredible things. And I continue to get inspired each time I have these chats with each one of these remarkable people like my guest today. This, I'll give you the setup, is somebody who I grew up in Seattle, Washington. Every single day I was out on the playground and throwing the football, rain or shine. I had made my way through Roosevelt High School, the big local high school up there in Seattle. I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship to the University of Washington. And as I was there, the Seahawks were just emerging. And so today, through a mutual friend, Tom Flick, I was able to get a former Seahawk great quarterback, Jim Zorn, on the pod. So I want to first welcome you. Jim, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. And I hope this isn't underwhelming after 225 awesome podcasts.
Oh, man, this is going to be right up there. I mean, in the one thing, there's so many elements. We're going to kind of go through your career just a little bit, but there's so many elements of your career. And not only was the flash that you had being a lefty running all over the field, throwing to the guy that I really looked up to because I was also a wide receiver, your buddy Steve Largen, who has also been on the podcast. But I think you've always gone about life the right way. You've always had a really strong moral compass, and that's the way I've always looked at you. You've always treated people with respect despite the heights of greatness that you achieved on the field, which, of course, you're playing quarterback, and off the field, which you've had this amazing run coaching in the NFL for a long time, which we'll get into. But let's go back to, we all have influences, because I can't imagine that you know, you are who you are and you're a man of character, and that's great. But you must have had some kind of mentor or influence growing up to set kind of the whole stage of what your life would become.
Yeah, I think for me, it's probably a series of influences. You know, I can tell you my high school football coach, and when I was I only had him 1 year when I was a senior in high school, he taught me some things about the game that I didn't know. When I got to Cal, the powerhouse Cal Poly Pomona, which is where I played 2 years of football, my junior year and my senior year, the very first game I ever played at Cal Poly was against Fresno State University. And I can still remember our head coach running out on the field after we had beaten Fresno State. And we shouldn't have, because we were that warm-up game for Fresno State, but we ended up beating them. And he came out on the field And he just looked right at me, and nobody had ever said this to me before. You are a great player. You're going to be a great QB. And, you know, he got right in my face. He was pretty excited, more excited than I ever imagined, because I had never thought of myself like that. And so that was a big influence. And then probably another major influence was going, signing as a free agent. I didn't get drafted, but I signed as a free agent with the Dallas Cowboys, and Tom Landry was the head football coach. Mm-hmm. And so he was a major influence for me. And then Roger Staubach was the starting quarterback, and he is that steady guy, you know, and loved to compete. He's a little bit of a rascal, you know, he loves to have fun, but man, he can compete, and he's just a steady guy, true man, you know, that I was influenced by. And, you know, I think those experiences kind of formed a basis for me. And there were others, you know, I have a commitment to Christ, and my foundation is based in Christianity, which a lot of people might go, you know, he's so narrow now, you know, what is it about this guy? But it's a tremendous foundation to be a part of. And there were influences in my life, in my spiritual life as well. And it kind of all fits together into lifestyle and, you know, continuing to progress through life. There's still people influencing me. You're influencing me, mm-hmm. you know, just even having me on and having this conversation.
Well, that's very generous of you to say. You know, one of the things I was thinking about this other day, and I think the mental shifts I had to make, there was two of them. One was when I first went from my high school to the University of Washington, and I was looking out there, a lot of these great players like your buddy Tom Flick, and I just didn't see myself. I physically couldn't compete at that level yet because I'd never lifted weights. And then the second point is I didn't think in my mind that I could actually play at that level. And so it took me a number of years for that mental shift to think much larger. And then when I got down to the NFL and the way that L. Davis would run a team and all the fancy cars coming in and the big money, as you know, I mean, it's even grander now. But there's just the whole thing about two things. Like, one, why not me? And two, thinking big. And thinking big was that the NFL, I mean, it's really hard to make it, and it's even harder to stay there. But why can't you do both? And you did. You played 11, 12 years, and you had this amazing career. And you went from this small little Cal Poly, you know, where you were out there running around. You never played against the USC's and these other big teams, but you had to somewhere in there get that shift, make that mental shift that, like, you could hang with these big boys.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, I can relate to that. When I was a senior in college at Cal Poly Pomona, Pat Hayden, who was at USC, he was the major quarterback from Southern California, and I was University Player of the Year of all universities down there. So that kind of helped. And then when I went to the Dallas Cowboys, in that era, there were only 43 players. There was no practice squad. So that year, the Cowboys drafted Randy White, Thomas Henderson, Bob Brunig was on the team. I could name a dozen guys and me. 13 rookies made the football team that year. And so I ended up getting cut. They stayed with two quarterbacks because we had a guy that got injured and they didn't want to put him on injured reserve. So they had to make room. They traded, some people remember this, but they traded with the Steelers for Preston Pearson. And he came in as a running back to help the running back group. And they kind of put me on the sideline out of the fold, if you will, to try to get me to hang on in case they had an injury. And then the Seahawks the following year came about. And so I went to Seattle. And so that part is historical. But my major goal when I was with the Cowboys working out to try to prepare for training camp was I was going to try to eliminate anything that could get me cut other than not being a very good football player. So I worked out really hard. I did all the things that I could, so they couldn't cut me because of my strength training, my conditioning, even my throwing and things like that. They had to cut me because I couldn't do it. I couldn't either remember plays or whatever. And when I was done, it was the same feeling maybe that you had. It's like, wait a minute, I can do this. I can go on and play now. And so nothing really intimidated me after that. And isn't it true? You know, sometimes the things that intimidate are it's the unknown. And I've never been really embarrassed or shied away from trying things. I'm kind of a curious guy. And I do know this, and you may have experienced this changing your interests from football to mountain climbing, because you have to be willing to be, I would say, embarrassed, or at least be the low man on the totem pole before you can experience the kind of greatness that you've experienced maybe more than twice over now. And I think that's the same. You have to be willing to try it, fail, try it again, fail, get a little bit better, and then you're on your way. But you have to be willing to step out there and be embarrassed a little bit about not being very good. And I think I was willing to do that.
Yeah, no, there's no question. And I think there's a pattern over all of our lives. Like if anybody, you've done things that have been very visible. And so it's easy to look at your life and say, you know, you've had peaks and you've had valleys, certainly, right? Through playing football to being ultimately, you served as a backup role, and ultimately, like we all do, get cut, right? It comes to an end. And then from the coaching, you know, you've risen up the ranks and you've fallen off and you've risen up and you've fallen off. And that's just the way it goes. If you're going to be a coach, it doesn't matter who you are, you're going to live a life of a nomad, continuing to move around the league. And so I think going back to what you said, which is really key, which is stepping into the fear. That's more or less what you just said. Be willing to try new things, right? And I think where the rubber meets the road is stepping into the fear. And then you have to do it with daily discipline. So you talked about you're going to show up at camp having lifted the weights, ran the stairs, thrown the ball. So they weren't going to catch you because you weren't prepared. As a quarterback, especially, you're the leader of the team. You need to have that playbook down. You need to know everybody's position. So you weren't going to show up not knowing that. And then last thing to me, that of those three pillars, step into the fear, do it with daily discipline, is then commit, right? You're going to make a full commitment in your life. And that's just something I think that, again, that from as a person from distance, because I've been, you know, part of the Jim Zorn fan club for a long time, and watching you, you've always done things with the commitment of excellence, of trying to get better, of continuing to work and totally committed to the goal at hand, whether it's been coaching or whether it's been playing football, you know, on the field, which has been really cool to watch. And again, it serves, you're doing because that's what has worked for you and that's your successful model, but it has served as a beacon of light for so many others that are looking up to you and following you because you're in the public eye and, you know, it's how you respond to all these adversities.
Yeah. I think just to add to that, you know, talking about that stepping into the fear, that portion of it for me, I think joy, my wife, I've been married a really long time. I'm super old, but I've been married 42 years now, and joy has always said, you know, you like to risk things. You like to take risks. You like to risk things. And I think stepping into situations that you may not have confidence in initially or whatever, it's stepping into that fear. But, you know, alongside that, it's really just, it's risk taking. And you have to evaluate how much risk you're willing to take. And, you know, I always say, well, you know, the only risk that I've ever, you know, I don't like to risk my life, if you will, but what I have risked is being embarrassed, or I have risked failing. And so, you know, those are the things, if you will, when you step into that fear, what you did is take a risk, you know, of not doing well the first time or whatever. If you don't mind me asking questions, do you feel like all the stuff you've learned in mountain climbing that you've made it less risky. You know where those risks are about the steps you take now, but they're not as unknown for most of the experience, just those few risky moments, I guess. I don't know. What is it for you?
I would say, you know, I think this is just life in general. It's measured risk, right? So to your point, you don't go from Little League to the NFL in one jump, right? Both of us have these iterations on our way up. You don't go from a little mountain here in Sun Valley to Mount Everest, the highest mountain in the world. You know, it took me 10 years going around. And, you know, the last time I saw you physically, I was stood upon, you know, at the top of Tiger Mountain. It's just a small little mountain outside of Seattle, a couple miles up and down. And it's steep, but I've probably been on top of that mountain as my training ground at least 150 times, you know, because I was committed every single week, year round, in snow, in sleet, in rain, in sun, everything. I always showed up. And I think that is the whole key. And then you learn things. You also said something else in there, which is I've really had to learn, because I really wasn't able to grow until I could really put this in my pocket, which is the whole concept around being much more vulnerable, right? And because that led directly to me having the ego that was standing in the way of allowing myself to fail and do that publicly, right? And show myself, and it's okay. You're a strong presence when you walk in the room. Everybody knows who you are, and you don't, despite your successes or your failures, nobody looks at you any differently. You know, you have a presence about yourself. But I always thought that if I showed like my true emotions walking into a room and saying like, I really did bump my head this time, like that would make me less of a person. And I found out that actually made me a stronger person. And that's really helped me in my growth. And where I'm still on that trajectory, trying to go up and learn. So I haven't got there yet, but you know, these are a lot of lessons learned metaphorically about climbing mountains and going two steps back and one forward and two steps back and one forward. I want to go back to 1976 really quickly, because you came to Seattle. I'm from Seattle, and we were so excited because this was our first NFL franchise that was launching in the city, that all these years we had been out trying to bid for one. And now the Seahawks land in our lap. And they've been up there ever since, new stadium. And at the time, I remember this like it was yesterday, you guys would go over to Eastern Washington, Jack Patera was the head coach. And I can only imagine one of your strengths that played in your favor was your ability to run and scramble and get around things and your accuracy. And so certainly that probably played into ultimately you being named the starter. But I just remember these old tales where Jack Patera was so hardcore that he wouldn't allow any water. It was probably 100 degrees and super dry over there over in Cheney, right, where I've been many times. And, you know, like, how could anybody even survive that? So I'm asking you, how did you survive that?
Well, you learned how to prehydrate, right? And that's really true. Jack didn't allow water. And so we took salt pills and we hydrated. I mean, we drank a lot before we went to practice, and he had nothing. He didn't want to take a break. He didn't want to do anything. And I just remember, I think some of the players would get the ball boys to sneak ice in towels, ice chips, so they could have at least something going on. But you know, I just think that today we would think that would be ridiculous. It was just something that, okay, no water. Is that what you want? Yeah, I don't want water. Okay. And nobody had water on the field. Now, we had water out there before practice, then they put it away. And then right after practice, you know, water would come out and you get water right after practice on the field. But not during the time. We didn't have many guys fall out. I do remember Mike Curtis came from the Baltimore Colts, and he was a middle linebacker. And I do remember him calling the league office one day before practice to see if we could skip practice because it was too hot outside. So he's called the league, you know, hey, it's 105. Do we have to practice today? Yes, sorry, Mike, you have to practice today. No. So, yeah, it was hot. I spent a lot of years there. And yet, all the years that Jack Patera was there, there was no water on the field from the very first year to when he was done.
That's incredible. You know, your buddy, Steve Larson, also, I asked him about it. He said something very similar, and he described it more like a popsicle, but more or less the guy's sneaking
every
ice
once
out.
In a while, Jack would bring a popsicle out. He'd wear those big clown sunglasses. And, you know, he had a little sense of humor, but he would bring popsicles out. But that might have been twice all training camp. Yeah. And it wasn't like we had popsicles every day.
No, I know that. Well, he was famous for it, and he made you guys tough, you know, so you're competitive and a lot of characters on that team. It was fun to watch. We could spend all day talking about your football career, and at the end of the day, you know, there's a beginning and there's an end, and then at that end, you're like, okay, what am I going to do now? I mean, all those years that the guys that make it to the NFL level, you spend really zeroed in between college and then all the training caps. And then, you know, in order to be super successful, that's what you need to be focused on. And then you drive off the cliff. And now that big question of now what? And for you, you wanted to go into coaching. And another guy that we were talking about before we went live here is Coach Skip Hall. He was a coach that had been at the Washington my entire time. He called it the Camelot years. Those were all the years that we're going to the bowl games. I've got many of the different, he was talking about wearing his Orange Bowl to everybody that's on YouTube, right? I got a bunch of rings here from the Rose Bowl and other bowls that we went to, but he decided to give you his first break when he got to become the head coach at Boise State. And I'm reading his book now called Coach 'Em Up. And it's a really fun book to read. I know many of the different players and the coaches and everything else that he describes in there. But what was that transition like for you? So it's thrilling on one hand that you've got a job and you have some place to go, but I'm sure scary stepping into the fear of transitioning from you being the star quarterback to now going into a teaching mode. So what was that like for you?
Yeah. So one of the things that happened is I went in, Chuck Knox was the head coach here. And when I was done playing and I had finally decided, okay, I'm going to retire, I had gone to kind of trying to do a systematic, as much as I could, a systematic way of finding out, you know, what next. And so I took a year and started, you know, working on plans. I always thought that I'd be a coach, but I went in and said, I asked Chuck, I said, Chuck, I'd love to be able to be on your staff and I want to start my coaching career. Would you hire me? Thinking I knew everything, you know, all the things I already had to know. And he said, no, I'm not going to hire you. And I was, you know, I was mad, really. And I said, why? And he said, because you'll benefit more from being on our staff than we'll benefit from you being on our staff, especially in the early years. And I don't want to be your testing ground. I don't want to be your guinea pig, if you will. And so he said, my suggestion is you go and try to coach at the highest level you possibly can. And it didn't take but a couple months. And then Skip gave me a call and asked if I would be interested in coaching with him. And he'd already been at Boise State for a couple years, or maybe it had to be a couple years. And then he hired me as the quarterback coach. And then further on, he gave me the receivers, and I also coached the kickers and the punters because I held in the National Football League.
Yeah.
And, you know, there wasn't a lot of training from him. There were some things, but the training I got was from the assistant coaches, you know, because they're the ones in there. And I learned how to recruit. I learned how to be a committed coach and understand how to explain what we're trying to do on offense to my quarterbacks and be a part of the drill work and receivers and things like that. So I had a lot to learn, and I realized, oh my gosh, I don't really know the coaching side of it. I knew the playing side. So I was a little bit of a wild child when it came to, you know, do we really have to wear, I remember asking a question in one of the meetings, do we really have to wear these polyester shorts? You know, do we have to wear these? Do I have to wear this shirt that looks like, you know, it was made for other than football? Do I have to wear these? And so I had some influence, but I also learned that the head coach really has a vision, and he sends the team and his coaching staff in a direction. And so I learned real quick from being there that, you know, there was a lot of things that I needed to learn and develop over the years to get to the goal. If I had that goal of being an NFL coach and being on an NFL staff.
Well, you know, that's awesome. And as we started the conversation at the very beginning, it doesn't matter who you are or how successful you are. At some point in time, you're going to keep moving. Even my coach, Don James, moved around before he became the head guy at the University of Washington. And you had a unique experience because you were in Seattle at least 8 or 9 years before you went to a couple of other teams. So you had that consistency. And now you get in the world of coaching. And I just wrote down many of the different spots that you were in, but also you then left to Utah State, then you're in Minnesota, and you were also as an assistant coach with the in the NFL with the Ravens and Kansas City and the Lions and the Seahawks, as you mentioned before, with Mike Holmgren. But you know, you ultimately, after cutting your chops and going through the entire cycle and being in the game for a long time as a player and as a coach, you ultimately get the head gig at Washington. I still refer to them as the Redskins, but we're not calling them that anymore. And obviously, that didn't probably end the way you wanted it to. But from your standpoint, again, about life's lessons, tell me what the good about that experience was and tell me what the challenges were of that experience.
Well, I felt like I was ready for that head coaching position. And I felt that it was different circumstances than what a head coach, say, would do if he was coming in and trying to build a program. I had 14 coaches that were already there that I did not hire. And I thought we came together, you know, and I told these guys when I first came in, you're now my coaches, right? Because they had already been hired. They had already been on the staff with Joe Gibbs, who was the head coach before I was there. And they had gone in a direction, drafting a certain way, and creating an environment. So my job was to come in and be the head coach, accept these guys that I'm trying to get to know. And then I did hire a few guys, but my job was to create, again, the vision as the head football coach. This is the direction that we're going to go. This is how we're going to build. And you know, I think everybody would think I was going to, you know, you're going to build year after year after year. And it was not so because, you know, and, you know, there's so many circumstances that made it not so. And I think one of the bigger ones was, you know, I was replaced by Mike Shanahan, and Mike had been let go by the Denver Broncos. And when that happened, you know, there was a lot of attention given to a former Super Bowl coach who was out there available. And, you know, so that, you know, those things kind of created some interest in that. And, you know, quite frankly, we fared well in our first year, and we didn't fare well in our second year. And there was a lot of discoveries going on within that second year. And I had, you know, I could make all kinds of reasoning. I know why, you know what I mean? But nobody likes to hear some of those whys because they sort of sound whiny, you know. Here's why, here's, the, you know, you. But I think as a coaching staff and as, you know, when you see it, even the team, when you see it, you can say, yep, I see it, I get it. But the deal was, I was let go after my second year, and I became a better coach along the way. And again, as a head coach, I knew how to lead, but I didn't try to lead and pound my will. Hey, you know, everybody, I wasn't wiping my snot bubbles and telling everybody, hey, it's my way or the highway. Because on a staff, there's a lot of really good ideas and there's some great experienced coaches in their own rights, in their own areas. And, you know, they brought a lot of value to, they bring a lot of value even today to a football team.
I don't think at the end of the day, there is no perfect ride. Even my brilliant head coach at the University of Washington, Don James, he left in protest because some sanctions were going to come down. It was a horrible way to leave for him, the guy that had been out there. But I do believe this. I look back at my life and I've had a whole bunch of bumps. I mean, way more bumps than I've had these peaks standing on top of Mount Everest. And I've even though they haven't made sense to me at the particular time in time and perspective looking back, there has actually been a reason. And there's been, you know, it's really actually put me in a better space, even though there's a lot of struggle to get. And I've had to find my way to get back up above water. But there's always a reason and there's a blessing in it somewhere. And it just maybe takes a couple of years to look back on it and really understand what that blessing actually is. Now, tell me if I have this right. The Seattle Dragons, are they in existence? I'm reading that they're coming back in 2022. Is that still happening?
Yes. So the Seattle Dragons is the XFL, right? The XFL. And I was the head coach here in Seattle. It went down when COVID came around. The league stopped. Vince McMahon owned the league. He decided to take it into Chapter 11 bankruptcy and disassemble the league, which we did. And then he sold the league to The Rock, which has been publicized. And The Rock and I believe Danny Garcia have gotten together and they're putting together the structure of this continued XFL. And so they have hired now the executives and the people who are going to create this or continue on with this league. And then February, I believe next year at some point, they'll be hiring head coaches and going through the same process as we did as we put the league together. And then again, maybe I don't even know if we'll start with 8 teams or more. I don't know exactly how that's going to be structured, but they'll have the very first snap after the Super Bowl in 2023. So it'll be a whole year, 2022, there'll be a whole year of preparation. Now, if I'm fortunate, you know, I still have the energy to coach, and I'm hoping, regardless of whether I get to get hired or not, that there's a team here, that the Dragons continue here. We had a great time. We had great support by the fans of the, and what was really excellent is here comes a league that wants to start a football program in the spring. And so there's a lot of boxes to check when it comes to where you're going to practice, what are you going to call home? What are all the logistics of getting in and out of practice? And players starting to live in the Seattle area. That was 1 year, and it didn't really get to be fleshed out with multiple years. But I'm hoping Seattle did a great job of supporting its team, and it was on its, you know, I think it's on its way and worthy of being considered again. So we'll see what happens. The owners, the group of executives. Putting it together are doing it the right way, I believe. And they've been quiet about any coaches yet. No announcements.
Yeah, got it. So if I'm making this up, if the Raiders or if the Cincinnati Bengals or somebody were to pick up the phone and call you, would you go back and coach in a different city?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd pick up and go. Yeah, absolutely. I think Joy would come and visit me, yeah. My wife.
Yeah.
But I get that. I think, we have we have grandkids around here now, and she's pretty locked in here. But I've got energy to be on a staff anywhere. Absolutely.
Well, there's no question you have energy. And, you know, I really feel strongly about this. I wouldn't just throw this out if I didn't mean it, which is good things happen to good people, and you're a good person. And you've had this long history. You have so much knowledge to impart on these young kids, not only from the football smarts IQ part of it, but just from the, again, the moral compass of what it takes. And, you know, you and I constantly see these tragic situations, like what happened with the wide receiver down in Oakland, or I'm sorry, in Las Vegas, you know, driving a fast car and out too late and drinking and just doing all the wrong things. And, you know, like you came into the league, there's a right way to do it and there's a wrong way to do it. And what people need to know is the league doesn't need you, right? And so you got to do everything you possibly can to make them want you and to stick around.
Yeah, I do think that we have, I've been around so many teams, you have as well. And you think, how could you make that kind of decision? Remember, we were talking about when you make these decisions, you're risking things. And some things you don't need to risk, or you can postpone it until later. And, you know, there's a lot of principles out there of delaying, you know, whatever you want to do today, you could delay that. You could still have fun or whatever, but you can delay present pleasures for future benefits.
Yeah.
And that's really what you try to preach as a coach, but you try to do as a player, and to see some of the decisions that get made, kind of think, what was he thinking? And some of it's careless. And then some of it is, some players are more followers, right, than they are leaders. But when you're on a team, there's some responsibility, there's some accountability with your teammates. And that's what I try to say you want to trust the guy that's next to you, and he wants to trust you, needs to be able to play together. And then, when you're making serious decisions like that, usually the guys that are making those decisions, they're the ones that are quiet and off and by themselves anyway, or they've got their own little agenda. They got a separate agenda. And I've seen those kinds of players even brought back in and saying, no, you're not going to do that because I'm playing on this team and we need you on this team. And so there's some good leadership as well. If you don't have quality leadership, if you got wishy-washy leaders, then it makes it tough to be able to have that guy tell this guy, you're not doing that. You're not making that decision, kind of helping him out. Indirectly, he doesn't even know he's being helped out, but he really is.
Well, look, from a former Seattleite myself, certainly having lived half my life in Seattle, and I still continue to visit. I was there this last weekend, continue to belong to some different organizations up there. I know I'm speaking for the city that, you know, you are a true Seattle legend. You know, you're part of the sports fabric that's out there. And, you know, I think Seattle is so blessed to have had you in their presence. You continue to be in that area and serve as you do. And so thank you, number one, for coming on the show. Number two, it's awesome to get caught up with you from just that 1 5-minute time up on top of Tiger Mountain. And I actually get to spend a full hour. And I can actually say one of my bucket list in life is to have both you and Largent on the podcast, which I've now completed.
Right on.
Very thankful for that.
Thanks for having me. And when you get to Seattle, let's get together. We'll do something over a meal and have another conversation. And then I tip my hat to you too for taking care of your daughter and her needs and those kinds of things, because, you know, that takes work as well. And I haven't met her, but how old is she now, your daughter?
She's 23 years old, and this is something that has been really amazing. That, you know, by putting her as kind of the poster child for Emilius Everest, a program underneath the Higher Ground nonprofit here in Sun Valley, she's had to speak in front of 300, 400 people. She was in the movie Searching for the Summit.
She's been asked to be out in front a number of times, and she's had to really take that ownership on of like, look, I have epilepsy and it's not fun, but that's what I've had. But she has not had a seizure for the first time in the last 8 months. She's not had a seizure. And I really believe that's because of the empowerment. And, you know, I think it's a couple different things, but certainly that's, you know, that's one of them. And, you know, I'm just knock on wood every day. Like we continue down this path and it's just been a long journey, and she's had epilepsy since she was six. So it's a long time.
Wow. Yeah, it is. That's a battle.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So way to go. Keep fighting in there. Thanks again for having me. I think your blog, I keep calling them blogs, but your podcast is great. I wish you all the best, and look me up when you come to Seattle. We'll get together.
All right. There he is. The one, the only, Jim Zorn. Thank you so much.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.